on boats in the Caribbean. We just had news that three more boats have been attacked by the United States and eight people killed. What is the CIA's involvement in this series of attacks?
Well, what I reported back then was that the CIA is providing the most important part because they're providing the intelligence, picking which boats, and they pass the information on to the military, which does the strikes. The drones, we believe they're drones that are launching these missiles like Hellfires. The CIA is providing the information and what you'd call evidence, but it's not evidence, it's intelligence about where drugs are, how many people are on the boat, where it left, where it's going to, and whether there's been sort of radio traffic from it that they can use to triangulate what it's doing. I think that's why, or the sources said, it was the most important part of it, because it's the intelligence. And the CIA, its name had, its role hadn't been sort of described yet. It plays this key role in picking, you know, the targets that are chosen by the military for destruction.
Aaron Rosten, I want to thank you for being with us. Emmy award-winning reporter. He writes for The Guardian U.S. We'll link to your piece. They're trying to get rich off it. U.S. contractors vie to rebuild Gaza with alligator Alcatraz team in the lead. Aaron is also the author of the book, The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Extraordinary Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmed Chalabi. That does it for our show. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
You are listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 to contribute today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition raises concerns about ICE agents posing as utility workers. Students across Portland walk out in protest of ICE. And in national news, a judge won't pause the redevelopment of the White House East Wing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 16, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, or PIRC, published their weekly update earlier today. They report 60 detentions were reported to their hotline last week. Violent immigration arrests have become commonplace in the last few months at the hands of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Last week, unionized nurses at Legacy Hospital in Portland raised alarm bells about alleged illegal and unprecedented access ICE agents had over detainees they brought in for medical care. That included sitting in on sensitive conversations, blocking nurses from giving someone an IV, shackled someone to a bed when they posed no threat, and checking out a patient before it was medically safe to do so. Legacy Hospital management has said the allegations from the unionized nurses are untrue. PIRC also reported what they call a, quote, alarming new tactic of ICE agents posing as utility workers. They offered advice to the community on how to spot a real utilities worker. PIRC says to look for official trucks with logos and flashing lights. Real utilities workers will have uniforms or high-vis vests with logos plus a photo ID from their company. PIRC reminds people that they should have received prior contact about the utility company coming to their building and that folks can always ask for photo ID and verify their identity by calling the company's phone number found on their website. They say if folks are unsure, they shouldn't open the door and instead keep the door closed and speak through it or through a window. Portland students from 9 different area high schools walked out of class this afternoon to protest ICE. Some made their way down to City Hall in the afternoon, while other students, like those at McDaniel High School, protested closer to their building. A flyer for the walkout read, quote, "Students in the PPS districts are walking out to protest abuses by ICE, honor those who have passed in detention centers, and demand safety, dignity, and due process for all immigrants in our community," end quote. This follows other student walkouts earlier this month in the Portland area. Hundreds of Washington County students walked out of school on December 8th to protest ICE aggression. Washington County has been hit particularly hard by violent ICE arrests in recent months. The research community is out with new findings that show major shifts in living arrangements over the past 50 years, pointing to trends that overlap with access to affordable housing. As Mike Moen reports, a local assistance office in North Dakota says the data illustrate how demand for low-cost units is affected.
A decline in married couple households and a rise in the number of older adult households are part of the dynamics reshaping living arrangements in the U.S. A North Dakota office says the Census Bureau update resonates in affordable housing circles. The Bureau this month issued a summary comparing these data points to what was seen around America 50 years ago. For example, the portion of householders aged 65 and older rose from 1 in 5 in 1975 to over 1 in 4 in 2025. Damian Schlinger leads the Burley County Housing Authority, which helps local residents access affordable units. He sees a connection between these trends and the clients his team works with.
So those demographic shifts mean we're seeing greater demand for accessible one-bedroom units for seniors on fixed incomes, while working families, they face longer waits for larger units that they need.
Schlinger says higher interest rates and other factors are forcing seniors to hold on to their affordable rental units as long as possible. Analysts say shrinking family sizes also are causing pressure, with the cost of living prompting younger adults to avoid seeking larger dwellings. The census estimate says in 2025, one-person households accounted for 29% of all households, up from 20% in 1975. The December summary also reveals that in 2025, more than half of adults ages 18 to 24 lived in their parental home. The Census Bureau's Paul Jaimes says that tracks with other recent information they've gathered.
We have data from an earlier report that indicates that living in a parental home has become more common for young adults, and this is true for both 18 to 24-year-olds and 25 to 34-year-olds.
Burley County's Damian Schlinger stresses the changes seen among young adults isn't about delayed independence, but rather a clear indicator of the affordable housing crisis. He says the nation can't afford to hold back on making big investments in this area.
Stable, affordable housing is foundational to everything we do: education, health, workforce participation, and community stability.
He says it'll take a lot of partners at all levels to keep carving out solutions. The state of North Dakota has set aside money to close gaps, but housing assistance offices are dealing with federal uncertainty, with the Trump administration pursuing cuts for permanent housing programs. The administration argues certain initiatives need more accountability. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
The Oregon Government Ethics Commission will investigate six Portland city councilors on whether they violated public meetings law when they met for a retreat in August. Councilors Candace Avalos, Jamie Dunphy, Mitch Green, Samir Canal, Tiffany Koyama-Lane, and Angelita Murillo are each under investigation. The progressive councilors met in early August for a retreat, reportedly to discuss a number of topics, including the idea of defunding Prosper Portland, the city's development agency. Oregon public meetings law bans legislators from meeting privately to talk about legislative matters with enough people to make a quorum. For Portland's 12-member city council, 7 is a quorum. So while councilors are okay on that front, the investigation questions whether the policy committees, made up of 5 members, might have had their quorum reached. The progressive members make up a 3-person majority on 4 different committees, so the complaint argues there should have been a breach of public meeting law. At a meeting of the Ethics Commission this week, Oregon Justice Resource Center attorney Ben Hale represented the councilors and defended their actions. Hale said, quote, "They did not talk about anything that would be decided by City Council or any of its committees." The Ethics Committee will meet on this investigation again in May. The Trump administration declares in a court that the White House ballroom construction project must continue for unexplained national security reasons. Last week, the National Trust for Historic Preservation asked a federal judge to halt Donald Trump's project until it goes through multiple independent reviews, entertains a public comment period, and is approved by Congress. The administration's 36-page filing included a declaration from Matthew C. Quinn, deputy director of the U.S. Secret Service. The filing did not explain those specific national security concerns, but the administration has offered to share classified details with the judge in private. The East Wing did sit on top of an emergency operations bunker for the president. Quinn said even a temporary halt to construction would hamper the agency's ability to fulfill its statutory obligations and its protective mission. The trust suing to stop it said in their suit, quote, "No president is legally allowed to tear down portions of the White House without any review whatsoever. Not President Trump, not President Biden, not anyone else, and no president is legally allowed to construct a ballroom on public property without giving the public an opportunity to weigh in," end quote. The trust also asserts that the plans should have been submitted to the National Capital Planning Commission, the Commission of Fine Arts, and Congress before any action was taken. Trump already had the East Wing torn down in October as part of his plan to build an estimated $300 million, 90,000-square-foot ballroom, able to accommodate about 1,000 people. The lawsuit cites several federal statutes and rules detailing the role the Planning and Fine Arts Commission and lawmakers should play in U.S. government construction projects. The administration argued in its response that the president has the authority to modify the White House and included the extensive history of changes and additions to the executive mansion since it was built more than 200 years ago. In federal court today, Judge Richard Leon indicated he will not order Donald Trump to immediately stop work on the ballroom, but the judge left open the possibility that he could intervene in the legal fight. For now, Leon said, the nation's top historic preservation group that sued over the project had not shown how it was being irreparably harmed by the construction in a way that required immediate court intervention. Above ground construction is not anticipated to begin until April of 2026. Groups working to curb gun violence call for changes after latest mass shootings. President Trump declares fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction, and the U.S. House debates healthcare plans. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Gun violence does not pause for anniversaries. It does not respect campuses, classrooms, or places of reflection. It follows survivors wherever they go.
Gun control advocates like Paul Murray of the Newtown Action Alliance are again calling on Congress to legislate in the wake of a shooting at Brown University and other attacks. A gunman killed 2 and injured 9 at the Rhode Island College one day after the anniversary of the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting, where 26 died. There have been more than 150 shootings at U.S. schools and colleges this year, and several Brown students say they've survived previous attacks. President Donald Trump is declaring fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Although Venezuela doesn't produce or ship much of the narcotic, the executive order is the latest escalation with the South American nation. Trump claims the drug is sent to America to kill people, not to make profits, and calls it worse than any bomb.
If this were a war, that would be one of the worst wars. I believe they killed over the last 5 or 6 years, per year, 200 to 300,000 people. You hear about 100,000, which is a lot of people, but the number is much higher than that.
The CDC says as many as 350,000 total people have died fentanyl overdoses in 5 years, and the number declined recently due in part to tighter Chinese export controls and more stringent policing during Trump and Joe Biden's terms. New polls show most Americans oppose military action against Venezuela. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth continues to defend a series of attacks on alleged drug boats, including the strike that killed 2 survivors clinging to burning wreckage. Michigan Democratic Representative Sri Tendar is introducing legislation calling for his impeachment.
From issuing orders to kill everybody on board a small boat with no evidence of wrongdoing to launching a follow-up strike to finish off survivors barely clinging to their life, his actions are not just reprehensible, but illegal as well.
Congress is debating health care this week in the hope of preventing Affordable Care Act subsidies from expiring. Democrats and Republicans introduced separate bills in the Senate, but both failed. A House GOP leadership plan calls for expanding the availability of low-cost, low-coverage insurance, new transparency requirements on pharmacy benefit managers, and funding for certain kinds of cost-sharing reductions to premiums. Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries dismisses those proposals as entirely inadequate.
Mike Johnson hasn't reached out to us as Democrats to have a conversation about finding a path forward, which suggests to me that Mike Johnson is not serious about protecting the health care of the American people.
Several long-shot efforts in the House, some with bipartisan support, would extend the subsidies. Experts say without them, ACA plan premiums will more than double, forcing millions to go without coverage. Farmers nationwide will receive federal aid after being hit by higher costs, many the result of Trump administration tariffs. The money to fund what's being called bridge payments is coming from the revenue collected via the import taxes, but Ben Lilliston with the Nonprofit Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy calls this a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
When you don't have export markets, then you can start to have a glut of commodity crops primarily, but it could also be meat and poultry, and those prices start to go down for farmers. And so it's sort of a perfect storm of issues that farmers are facing.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to an end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with dance instructor Tony Carnell about a movement workshop they're hosting in January. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a chance of thunderstorms and an overnight low of 52 degrees. And tomorrow it will be rainy as well with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1773, the Boston Tea Party took place. American colonists disguised as Mohawk Indians threw 342 chests of tea belonging to the British East India Company into Boston Harbor to protest a tax on tea. The quote of the day is from Spanish philosopher George Santayana, born this day in 1863. He said, quote, "The young man who has not wept is a savage, and the older man who will not laugh is a fool." The Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation is increasing patrols for stray dogs, and a new documentary features boarding school remembrance in Arizona. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. The Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation, neighboring Fountain Hills, Arizona, recently dealt with reports of, quote, aggressive dogs running loose, resulting in attacks that prompted its police department to increase patrols while urging the public to stay away. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Two tribal members were bitten last week and are now recovering from non-lethal injuries, according to Acting Chief of Police Jesse Puffer.
We did catch 3 out of 4 dogs.
And incidents like this are not uncommon on tribal lands, with canines roaming their 24,000-acre reservation. Some are seen as strays, often dogs that are dumped there by owners who do not wish to keep them, while others are claimed by tribal members as pets.
We also have a dog ordinance, too, so people, they get cited for that as well. Depending on what the nature is, it could be anywhere from, you know, $150 fine, and it can be higher if you can't show record of vaccination and also licensing.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The documentary Remaining Native tracks Yerington, Nevada Paiute tribal member Koo Stevens as he confronts the horror of what his great-grandfather went through in boarding school. Stevens created a remembrance run tracking the same route his great-grandfather took to escape boarding school. KNPR's Jimmy Romo attended a screening of the film and brings us this report. And to note, this story includes accounts of violence against children.
In 1913, government officials ripped 8-year-old Yerington Paiute tribe member Frank Quinn from his family and placed him in the Stewart Indian Boarding School near Carson City. As a part of her history PhD studies at UNLV, Annie Delgado researches what actually happened to Native children in the U.S. boarding school system.
The early years are just filled with trauma and abuse and pain and just assimilation.
Many students try to escape the abuse. Quinn's great-grandson, Koo Stevens, is the protagonist in the documentary Remaining Native. In the film, viewers learned, along with Stevens, the story of his great-grandfather. To remember the courage of Native students who tried to escape, Stevens organized a remembrance run from Yerington to the Stewart Indian School.
Well, a local athlete from a smaller school here in northern Nevada is getting national attention for what he does both in his sport and for his people.
The first run took place in 2021, followed by three others. The route marked the same 50-mile run Quinn took to go back home.
I'm going to retrace the footsteps of my great-grandfather.
Here's Stevens.
You know, they're running, they're sweating, bleeding. I think of this guy, Russell, who I consider just like an uncle, broke both of his feet, like fractured them by the end of the run. And he did all 50 miles.
In the most recent class action lawsuit, the Wichita and affiliated tribes and the Washoe tribes of Nevada and California filed a case against the federal government in May. They were suing over misused funds. Currently, the sovereign nations are requesting that the U.S. itemize a $23 billion trust fund established by pressuring Native nations to sign agreements. Most of the treaties would promise that the U.S. would educate indigenous children in exchange for their land. But that wasn't what happened.
The United States government itself knows that these schools did not educate the way they intended to educate.
The communal trauma of boarding schools still affects indigenous families across the nation. The film Remaining Native is still available for community screenings.
That was Jimmy Romo reporting. The Bridging Agency Data Gaps and Ensuring Safety for Native Communities Act has passed the U.S. Senate. It supports the recruitment and retention of BIA law enforcement officers, bolsters federal missing persons resources, and gives tribes and states tools to combat MMIW. The legislation is led by Senators Catherine Cortez Masto, John Hoeven, Ruben Gallego, and Mike Rounds. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Trump administration's delay of the Environmental Protection Agency's national methane rule will heighten health risks and climate impacts for communities across the U.S., advocates say. The EPA's actions are drawing warnings from environmental justice groups who say not doing more to curb methane emissions will put lives at risk. Mark Richardson has the details in Utah.
Groups that work for environmental justice are concerned that a delay in Environmental Protection Agency methane emission rules will put thousands of lives in Utah and across the country at risk. The agency's 2024 methane rule would have required major reductions in methane emissions and other air pollution from the oil and gas industry. The EPA's move to delay it for 18 months has drawn strong criticism from groups, including We Act for Environmental Justice, which says local communities bear the health and economic burdens of this pollution. Joseph Robles with We Act says the delay could be deadly.
This delay is unfortunately more likely than not going to result in unnecessary deaths and increased hospital visits, or continuation of high rates of ER visits, public health burdens being placed on communities near it.
2016 report finds that air pollution from oil and gas results in 8 deaths per million Utah residents. The EPA's own analysis shows that methane rules could prevent 1,500 premature deaths and 100,000 asthma attacks each year. Utah doesn't have the same concentration of oil and gas refinery sites as Louisiana or Texas, but some neighborhoods face related risks from landfills, gas infrastructure, and industrial emitters. Robles warns that without stronger federal standards, methane and toxic pollutants will continue to worsen asthma, heat-related illness, and storm-driven exposure, especially for lower-income areas that already struggle with medical costs.
But increased extreme weather events, as well as many other impacts, is just going to continue hitting us harder every year that we delay important actions such as this one.
The EPA has pushed compliance at least into next year, and advocates say they're evaluating legal and policy options to ensure the rule is ultimately implemented. They argue stronger methane standards would reduce pollution, lower long-term health costs, and help states like Utah better withstand escalating climate-related disasters. For Utah News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
Trump's National Security Strategy paper shifts China policy from containment to economic competition, leaving U.S. deterrence of China mainly to allies. As one observer notes, that is good news for Beijing, not good news for Taiwan. He says if Trump doesn't get his big trade deal with China, he might well jettison the NSS guidelines. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Trump administration's National Security Strategy paper released this month is filled with nasty, nativist language and half-truths straight out of the Project 2025 playbook. But amidst the bluster about historic success in strengthening national security and resolving wars is a stark reminder of the direction U.S. foreign policy is taking, which looks to be a world divided into American, Chinese, and Russian spheres of influence. That would explain why Latin America receives so much more attention in the NSS paper than China or Russia. China, once viewed as a strategic rival, now is mainly considered an economic competitor. The NSS paper decries previous democratic efforts to bring China into a rules-based international system. It offers an alternative that really isn't, to, quote, rebalance America's economic relationship with China, prioritizing reciprocity and fairness to restore American economic independence, unquote. In other words, seek what previous administrations have sought with China. Get it to abide by rules of fair competition. The paper offers the usual American complaints about China's unfair trade policies, state subsidies, intellectual property theft, industrial espionage, etc. To counter China, the NSS says the administration will work with partners in Europe and Asia, protect critical infrastructure, and invest in research in cutting-edge military and dual-use technology. Nothing new there. One thing that is new is that the Trump administration has removed export restrictions on one of NVIDIA's most advanced AI computer chips, the H200, apparently in anticipation of a big deal on trade with China. Those are not the most powerful NVIDIA chips, but they might have military as well as commercial value. Yet, in announcing the deal, which includes giving the U.S. government 25% of sales, Trump assured one and all that the deal will be, quote, under conditions that allow for continued strong national security. Perhaps so, but China has reportedly turned down the H200, preferring to use semiconductor chips it has developed on its own. Evidently, the Trump administration, like Biden's, hasn't paid attention to the Chinese push for greater self-reliance in advanced technologies. Economic competition, the NSS paper says, quote, must be accompanied by a robust and ongoing focus on deterrence to prevent war in the Indo-Pacific and preventing domination in Asia by any single competitor nation. Achieving those goals is largely left to Japan, South Korea, Australia, and other partners. The paper says those partners should allow the U.S. military greater access to their ports and other facilities, spend more on their own defense, and most importantly, invest in capabilities aimed at deterring aggression. What is new here is not the goals, but the means to achieving them as the U.S. shifts naval power away from Asia and into Latin America. What does this shift mean for the most important arena of tension with China, Taiwan? Trump has wavered on U.S. policy on Taiwan, sometimes aligning with traditional strategic ambiguity over what the U.S. might do if China sought to absorb Taiwan, and at other times saying that Taiwan wasn't doing enough in its own defense while raking in money from its dominance in the semiconductor trade. The NSS paper recognizes Taiwan's economic value to the U.S., hence, quote, deterring a conflict over Taiwan, ideally by preserving military overmatch, is a priority. We will also maintain our long-standing declaratory policy on Taiwan, meaning that the U.S. does not support any unilateral change to the status quo in the Taiwan Strait, unquote. But that's not what Trump said as recently as a week ago when Xi Jinping thanked him for supporting One China, or what Trump did when he restrained Japan's prime minister from repeating her unprecedented pledge to counter a Chinese attack on Taiwan. The Taiwan leadership recognizes the weakened U.S. position in support of Taiwan and is pressing for a major increase in military spending. In sum, two things strike me about the China section of the National Security Paper. One is that it is more consistent with the China policy of recent Democratic administrations than it cares to admit on trade and deterrence. Where Trump has diverged from past policies is a willingness to engage in a tariff war with China, which he has already lost, and a lower valuation of traditional allies, such as Japan and South Korea. The second point is that these strategic documents, which every administration issues, may or may not be followed in practice. The previous Trump NSS gave no hint of Trump's leanings toward Russia or his strongly negative views of the European Union and NATO. We have to remember that we have a president who is capable of 180-degree policy turns at any moment. If Trump gets his big trade deal with China, he'll abide by the main guidelines in the NSS, but if not, expect a return to name-calling and tariff hikes. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and Carmel Pierre-Louis. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mark Richardson, Mike Mullen, Antonia Gonzalez, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hi, this is Carmel with KBOO News. Coming up in January, the group Heidi Duckler Dance Northwest is putting on a series of dance workshops that are open to the public. They will be hosting a series of dance workshops that are open to the public. They'll be hosted at Las Arioletas on Northeast Killingsworth here in Portland. I spoke with the instructor, Tony Carnell, to learn more.
I am Tony Carnell. I'm one of the project dancers and performing artists for Heidi Duckler Dance Northwest.
So you're hosting a series of movement workshops in January at Las Arioletas in Portland. What can you tell me about this workshop?
Yeah, we're super excited to be back at Las Arioletas. We started there a couple years ago. That little area of Portland is so full of incredible people and incredible